History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we'll just take the initiative to ask a few questions of some of our more seasoned neighbors, and more importantly, take the time to patiently listen to what comes back our way. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, it's not just that we're entertained, but so often we truly are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today you're going to hear the memories of two men who have most certainly inspired me over the years, two men who both happened to be on the receiving end of Imperial Japan's surprise attacks that drew the United States into World War II, and two men who both happened to celebrate their 101st birthdays earlier this week on the same day. The COVID-19 pandemic tempered the celebration in Albuquerque, New Mexico for Bill Overmyer, as it did in Central California for Frank Paredes. But by the end of this hour, I think you're going to be amazed that these two survived World War II, let alone the amazement that these two centenarians are still with us. February 15th, 1920 is the day these two entered the world. And while Bill Overmyer, who you're going to hear from in a bit, was taking his first breaths in Illinois, Frank Paredes was born into a family of 18. Yes, he was one of 16 kids born to a Mescalero Apache family in the Dragoon Mountains in southeastern Arizona, not too far from Tombstone. He was injured while working in a copper mine there at age 16, and at age 21 in September 1941, he enlisted in the Army.
They sent me to Hawaii. I was on my way to Manila to join the troops in Manila. So I was waiting in Pearl Harbor, Schofield Barracks, actually, on a cadre to go, waiting for more people to show up to go to Manila. But that's when I got caught, you know. Incidentally, a friend of mine, his name was Max Druin. He went in the Navy, and I went in the Army. He was aboard the USS West Virginia. I was in Schofield Barracks. So on Saturday night, December the 6th, I went to Pearl Harbor to visit with him. And we had a few beers, you know, and chatted, you know, about the hometown and this and that. I told Max, I says, I got to catch the last shuttle to Schofield Barracks. Otherwise, I'll be stranded here, you know. And I do help the priest say Mass on Sunday mornings. So I caught my shuttle, went back, and I made it okay. 8 o'clock, about 5 minutes to eight, I was on my way to church for Mass, and all of a sudden I heard a big noise, and the sirens went off, and they says, this is not a drill, this is not a drill. All personnel report to your stations. I didn't have a station, but we did have machine guns set up, you know. So what I did, I manned the first machine gun that I could find, and it was a Twin 50 on a Heinz mount. I spotted this torpedo bomber. It was probably about maybe 150, 200 feet up in the air. I could see the pilot, and I took a burst at him, and I missed him. Then I gave him a lead, and then I took another burst at him, and I smoked him. I don't know whether he went down, but I'm pretty sure he did went down because he started going towards the ocean. So that's where everything went haywire. So I start picking up, fighting fires, helping out, you know, with whatever I did. And I helped for about maybe 7 or 8 days. And then I got on, they put me on a ship, and I was on my way to Australia.
Well, let me come back to that, because I want to, before we get too far past it, I want to ask you about that time on Oahu. Because you described it, and I know you lived it, and you probably tell these stories a few times. But you're a 21-year-old kid. You're on your way to Mass, and all of a sudden, World War II begins for America, and you're right there in the thick of it, and you hop on a machine gun, and shoot a Japanese plane. What did this feel like? Because I imagine that's a pretty big shock to your system, that all of a sudden you're at war and the world is crazy. How did you deal with that?
I know it was crazy. So I joined the military for one thing and one thing only, to do what I had to do for my country. And that's what I did.
Was it scary for you in that moment? I mean, this is day one. I mean, you knew maybe something was going to happen at some point, but now it's actually here right in your face.
Yeah, it was scary. But the way I figured, you live one day at a time. And that's the way it went, you know, all through my military life.
Were you around Schofield Barracks cleaning up, or did you go down to the harbor and help with pulling bodies out of the water and all that?
Yes, I went to, I start pulling bodies, limbs, you know, arms, legs, you know, and heads, and it was awful. Thinking about it, you know, it makes me cry. The poor people, innocent people that got caught in a turmoil like that.
And I know there are other moments, because this is just the start of the war and you were in for a while, but when you think back specifically about December 7th, is there part of you that says, yeah, I could have been one of those more than 2,000 that died there?
Yes, I lost a few friends. I lost, especially in Schofield Barracks, I lost a few friends there. And then aboard the USS Arizona, I lost a cousin. His name was William Webb. I found out that when after the war, I went to my cousin's, you know, to his mom, you know, her name was Clotilde. She says, I'm very proud of my son. He died a hero. Anyway, that's about all I can remember about him, you know. But getting back to picking up bodies, parts of bodies, taking them, you know, to a grave registration. It took a while, you know, to get everything, you know, squared away.
When I talk to guys who are at Pearl Harbor, and I talk to guys who just served in the war, period, remember Pearl Harbor. I mean, it was three words that seemed to hold a lot of weight for them. For you, as you go on, and we're going to hear some of your adventures in the rest of the war, how big of a motivation was what you had seen and experienced at Pearl Harbor? What did remember Pearl Harbor mean to you?
It meant to me that remember Pearl Harbor, keep on going and give them hell. And that's what we did.
But one of the first ways he did that was rather unexpected. You heard him mention he had been headed to Australia, and that's where he was in May of 1942.
After the Battle of the Coral Sea, we weren't getting no supplies. No, the Air Force asked for volunteers, and I volunteered to be a machine gunner on a B-25. And going towards Port Moresby to make a bombing run, we got one of our wings shot off, so we had to bail out. That was my first parachute jump.
So you're in the Army, but you're still not assigned to any division or outfit, right? And they wanted volunteers to go on B-25s?
They needed a gunner. Everything was going to Europe at the start of the war in the Pacific. So Europe was getting all the supplies, and they needed a volunteer gunner. That was the 5th Air Force. So I volunteered, and as we were making our run over Port Moresby, New Guinea, anti-aircraft or guns, you know, start shooting at us, and they blew part of our wing off. So the pilot says, get ready to bail out. I had never bailed out.
Well, you haven't had any aerial training at all, right?
No, I've never had any aerial training at all.
Doesn't that sound a little ridiculous to you?
Right. But, I mean, I enlisted to do what I had to do. Yeah. So I bailed out. Everybody got safe. The plane crashed naturally, you know, because we abandoned the plane. But we landed in the water, and we were there for a couple of hours. But we had Mae West life jackets, and we had a vial that you squeezed it, and they would send out phosphorus. That was a shark repellent. There were sharks there, that was for sure. But in about 2 hours later, we got picked up by a PT boat, and they sent us back to Cairns. We got checked out and everything. So anyway, then I joined the 32nd Infantry Division, which was a Wisconsin National Guard. I joined the 126th Regiment, crossing the Owen Stanley Range. We were on the way to Buna Gona, but we were on the Kokoda Trail, and there was nothing but couldn't carry trucks or anything like that, you know. It was all pulled by horses. So anyway, we weren't getting any supplies or anything, you know. So we ran out of food. We got a lot of malaria, dysentery, dengue fever, fighting all the elements. And we were hungry. So we started eating horse meat till we got to Kokoda. And then we went all the way to Buna Gona. And Buna and Gona were still held by the Japanese. And I think the Navy did a lot of bombarding and this and that, you know. When I got to Buna Gona, they asked for volunteers because I had been, you know, in the ocean, you know. There was a new outfit which was called Special Amphibious Brigades. So I joined the 2nd Amphibious Brigade, and that's when I started making landings, you know, landing troops on D-Day landings. So I was assigned to the 1st Marine Division, and we did a lot of small landings and some big landings, too. And we also supplied the Coast Watchers. So anyway, one of my friends, he got caught by the Japanese, and they beheaded him.
Where was that?
That was in New Guinea.
And I'm sure that had to be really hard for you to deal with, and it probably also tells you what would happen to you if you got caught, right?
That's it.
You mentioned making beach landings. What were the beach landings that you were involved in?
The one that I remember the most was in Cape Lasser, New Britain. We went in there with the 1st Marine Division and the 32nd Infantry Division, the 126th Regiment. We landed them, came back, took another load of Marines and infantry, and then we wait for people to bring dead and wounded. Then I pick up the dead and the wounded and take them to the hospital ship, which was, you know, laid out, you know, offshore. Take them, unload them, and then go back and get another load. It would be maybe 10, 12 trips.
On what? On a LCVP or?
They were LCMs. My number was 696. I'll never forget that because, you know, it got full of holes, you know, by machine gun fire, you know, but we made it all right.
Well, and you mentioned machine gun holes, and I know that that duty to bring out the dead and wounded had to be very taxing emotionally, but you mentioned machine gun holes, and you told me you were wounded 3 times during the war. Where were those 3 occurrences? Tell me about them.
Once I got wounded in New Guinea, and the one that was going to treat me, he was a medic. The Marines called him corpsman, you know, but we called him medics. Called the medic, and when he came out to take care of me, he got shot. I got picked up with somebody else, I don't know who, and they took me to a hospital. They sent me back to Australia. I was in the hospital in Australia for a while. They took care of me good, you know, and then they sent me back to my unit.
Tell me how you got hit. What was happening at the time? How did it all unfold?
It was a banzai attack. Japanese, you know, they pulled a banzai on you whenever they could.
So you're in a defensive position, and all of a sudden a bullet from somewhere hits you? Where?
Oh, I got hit in the leg. In fact, I have a silver kneecap.
And then you call a medic, and then he gets killed trying to help you out. I mean, what goes through your head in a situation like that? It sounds pretty desperate to me.
Yes, but I mean, you know, I says, this wound is going to send me home. No way. They needed us over there.
And that was just the first time he was wounded. We'll hear about the other two when we come back, and also hear the story of yet another World War II survivor who turned 101 this week. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.